20th century, possibly 25 to 30 commentaries. So that we'll have a very well-rounded approach to how the Torah has been studied in the last 1,000 years. Okay, the first question that I pose is, what was it like to study Tanakh before Rashi? So the corollary to this question, perhaps to Rashi's background also, is number two, is why is it that if Jews were studying Bible for 1,000 years from the eyes of Drash, that means not such a straightforward approach to the verse, but a more indirect, or I should say a deeper approach at times. In order to fully understand the point I'm trying to make, it perhaps is worthwhile to differentiate right here and now between these two modes of learning Torah. Pshat, which means a simple approach, and Drash, which means a deeper approach. Pshat means, the simple Hebrew word, lahafshit, means to skin an animal, lahafshit. So pshat is the skin level understanding. Drash, v'darashta v'chakarta hetev, means you make a drisha, you make a deeper exposition of the text. Drash and pshat have many, many different rules guiding them. Pshat has to stick to the grammar, to the context of the story, to the syntax of the story, right? Meaning that singular has to say with singular, plural with plural, feminine with feminine, masculine with masculine. Drash can have Moshe talking to Paro about Yaakov and Esav, right? You say, what? Why Yaakov and Esav? So you want to delve deeper into the drash and give a deeper meaning of the drash, fine. That sometimes is always worthwhile. But drash does not necessarily have to stick with the rules, that the rigorous rules of pshat. Right? I assume that by now everyone in this room knows the basic difference between pshat and drash. Right? When Moshe first came to see Paro, his opening three words were Bini Bechori Yisrael. My son, my firstborn, is Israel. Rashi gives two interpretations. One, Bini means my people, my most important people, is the nation of Israel. Then Rashi gives what is obviously a drash. Bini means my son, literally my son. My Bechor is my firstborn, is Yaakov, also known as Yisrael. Rashi there says, now, forever, Esav will never have a claim to be the firstborn from this day on. Until now, maybe Esav had a claim that he was really the firstborn and Yaakov stole his blessing from him. Now, no longer. Now, why would Moshe tell that to Paro? That's why this is drash. Okay? So if it's drash, why write it in your commentary, Rashi? That is really what we have to do to answer question one and two. Why, if the Jews were satisfied to learn the Bible from the eyes of drash, what was available to a Jew to study at the time Rashi was born?
Medrash Rabbah.
Medrash Rabbah, good.
Unculus,
Targum Unculus, the Aramaic translation that you have in the Chumash, and the Agadot of the Gemara. Right, there were smatterings of Midrashim, but all basically like Medrash Rabbah. Some based more on textual expositions, that's more like Medrash Rabbah. Some based on more like sermonic materials, that's Medrash Tanchuma. But by and large, they were not interested in pshat. In fact, you've heard of this saying made very popular by Rashi, Ein mikro yotze midei pshuto, right? Out of 5,422 pages of Talmud, how many times do you think that is found in the Talmud? Three, and two in one Masechta. Two in Yevamos, one in Shabbos, that's it. Right? In other words, the point I'm trying to make is that if you only approach the Bible from the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, and certainly the Jerusalem Talmud, you would not have a keen appreciation for pshat.
So Rashi was counterintuitive?
So here's the, well, I don't mean to say that Rashi invented the idea at this time. He was part of something. It was part of something that was happening at this time in history. And it was like to study Tanakh before Rashi, actually within these pages I have, I'll show it to you another time, is that if you had a Chumash at the time of Rashi, it was simply the text of the Chumash with Targum. Text, Targum. Text, Targum. Nevi'im too. And Torah was Targum Onkelos, and Nevi'im was Targum Yonos and Uziel, and that was it. You didn't have anything but Targum. Right? So Rashi comes into the situation as such. And now, some of the things I'm about to tell you, especially today, more of the Rashi background part, comes from a voluminous work called Heichal Rashi by Yitzchak Avineri. Some just come from biographies of Rashi. Some are made more for children that tell some amazing stories of Rashi. All right, fine. Whenever something might be apocryphal, I'll tell you so. All right? Because how do we know these stories? Rashi was very private about his own personal life. We don't even know his wife's name. He had three daughters. We only know the name of two of them. Apparently did not have sons. He was extremely humble, although he did take a position of a chief rabbinate position in France. But the point is that when it comes to something that may be apocryphal, I'll tell you so. And here is where it starts. Apparently, Rashi started writing his Perush, what ended up being his commentary to the Torah, when he was 5. Why do I say that? Because Rashi, when commenting on the Mishnah, Chamisha L'Mikra, he says, the Torah, you should be 5 when you start studying Bible. So Rashi says a 5-year-old has a certain sensitivity, a certain feeling, especially in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, for the kind of questions that an older person might not be sensitive with. Okay, sensitive to. So according to the legends of Rashi, he already started taking notes. What bothers me when he was 5 years old? What's bothering me? Why does the Bible say one of the luminaries in the sky was large and one was small? One verse after telling me that they were both large. Right? So if you were a Pashtun like Ibn Ezra, you'd say there's no problem. We know that one is large and one is small, but for the human eye, they both look quite large. They're both large compared to everything else. The irony, of course, is that compared to the other things, those tiny things in the sky, those two are dwarfs. But the fact is, though, that from the human eye, these look big, even though the Torah is telling us that one is the source of the light and one receives the light. Whatever it is. But you know the famous Rashi, that God, Rashi injects into the story a moon that has intention and talks to God and says you can't have two luminaries at the same size, you have to make one bigger than the other. So he goes, okay, you make yourself small. So Rashi started writing things that bothered him, and as he became older, he gave an adult twist to these questions that might bother a 5-year-old, because the Mishnah says, after all, Chamisha L'Mikra. When you're 5, start learning Torah. So Rashi would write these little pamphlets, and this part actually starts with, he started writing commentaries to the Talmud also. Remember, at his time, it was even more difficult to study Talmud than to study Chumash. At least Chumash, you had your text right. When it came to the Talmud, there were many different versions of the Talmud, and Rashi had to decide what's the correct version. He used mostly Rabbeinu Gershom's version. Be it as it may, Rashi would write these small little pamphlets about this size. He'd paste them together and make a little book of it. A chapter here, a chapter there, a parak of Talmud. And he would leave them in study halls. And they became so popular, but no, he would never write who's writing these things. No one ever learned who's giving us chapter 3 of Moed Katan, who's giving us chapter 2 of Makos, who's giving us 10 chapters in Bereishis. And when it was discovered that this was who this was, they started to call him, I'm translating into English, the pamphleteer. The pamphleteer. And hence, whenever Tosfos quotes Rashi, it's always Perush HaKuntras. Rashi is quoted in Tosfos rarely as Rashi, but more often as Pei Hei. Pei Hei means Perush HaKuntras.
Kuntras is pamphlet.
Kuntras means pamphlet. Right? So this is how the world came to know about Rashi. Now back to our original point, though.
Did you say it was named that?
The pamphleteer. In Tosfos. Tosfos in the Gemara. So Rashi comes onto a world scene steeped in drash, and here are two explanations given amongst the scholars for why that is beginning to change. Rashi certainly revolutionized the idea by making it more popular, but I cannot say he invented the idea. The idea appears in the Talmud that there's something called pshat. But I will give you the two sides. They're brought down in many different scholarly works. If you have there's a beautiful sefer written about 70 years ago called Mavo LaMikra by Mem Tzadik Segel. Right, Moshe Tzadik Segel. So he wrote a few volumes. I have them here if you want to see it. And he posits the following. He says that there were around the time of Rashi, there were considerations, what we call klape pnim and klape chutz, in the Jewish community and outside the Jewish community. Let's start outside the Jewish community. Jews and Christians were often disputing the veracity of the Bible, vis-a-vis the question of whether the New Testament is actually the fulfillment of the Tanakh or not. Christians hold from the sanctity of our Tanakh fully. They just vastly vast differences as to the meaning of the prophecies, right? That was really the topic of a number of weeks last year, if you recall, right? So the Jews were engaged in disputations with Christians very often. If you look under D in Encyclopedia Judaica, they'll give you a list of hundreds of disputations that took place over the years in major disputations. Okay, so what started to happen was in the 9th and 10th centuries, these disputations started to proliferate. So let's say I'm sitting here in the year 950, 970, 900, 1000, and I'm arguing with a Christian. We actually took upon this particular issue last year over whether the Isaiah prophecy in chapter 7, verse 14, is actually a prediction of the virgin birth of Jesus or not. Right? This should bring back some memories from last year. And the Christian side is trying to prove that it says, Hine ha'alma hara violetet ben, the alma will become pregnant, give birth to a child, and that child will save you. So there you have it, virgin birth. Okay, how could you possibly deny such a prediction as the birth of Jesus? So if you were called upon, you had to be very careful, because if you were too convincing, they'd kill you for that. If you were disrespectful, they'd certainly kill you for that. Right? The Jews were under great, great duress. We actually saw a film, it was also last year, where Ramban, only because he was guaranteed total freedom of expression and argument, that he was able to make such forceful arguments, where the king of Spain said, I never heard someone I know to be so wrong sound so right. Right? So the Jew comes along and says, first let's look at the context of the story, because you can't understand the story, just take one verse out of context. After all, that verse was there to try to convince the king of Judah, remember I drew a map last year about this, to try to convince the king of Judah not to join a coalition with the northern kingdom and Aram against Assyria. Remember all that? So the king of Judah, Achaz, at the time, he said, I'm inclined, I have to join this coalition. I'm too weak, I can't stand up to Assyria myself. They're going to help me. He goes, no, they're not. They actually want to destroy you. They want to take you over. Don't do it. And it's not going to help you. Whoever joins this coalition is going to be destroyed soon. You wait out Assyria. God will save you from Assyria. He goes, no, I'm too weak. I can't do it. He goes, I'll ask for a sign. I'll give you a sign. He goes, no, I don't want a sign. I'm joining the coalition. He says, I'll give you the sign, you wicked king. He tells him, Hinei ha'alma ha'rovi oledet ben. That child will save you from the Assyrians. Now, this story is meant to give this king faith to hold out against the Assyrians. How does arguably a virgin birth some 600 years from now prove that this king now should have faith to hold out against the Assyrians? You following this? Right? So what's the first argument from Pshat? I gave it before. Context. You can't say that this is a virgin birth of Jesus 600 years from now. The context of the story is that this birth from an Alma is supposed to give you the faith, to the resolve to stand up to Assyria and to Aram and the Northern Kingdom, for that matter. Right? How does a virgin birth 600 years from now, even if you want to say that's what it means, give the king this strength? What's the second issue at hand here? The translation of the word, for goodness sakes. Alma does not mean a virgin. There's a good Hebrew word for that. That would be besula. Mm-hmm. Alma means a young woman. Okay, you can have an old besula and you can have a young non-besula. But Alma just means a young woman. So if you take out a concordance and look up the word Alma, sometimes it's actually a verse. Derech gever ba'alma. It's a woman, a married woman, and she's called an Alma. All right, so the point, however, is...
Was it the Septuagint that messed things up?
Right, so in the King James Version and all the ancient Christian versions, it's always sula. Right, they'll give the Greek word for besula. Now you find Christian interpretations will write young woman, because they're not going to be killed for that now. Right, so yes, of course, this was they all admit it now, because the word is Alma. I actually know of a converted former priest, because someone showed him in the New Testament that in the other four places of Alma, it appears as young maiden. And here in Isaiah, it's virgin. And when they showed it, he said, in the Greek, in the New Testament, and he said, but if you look at the original Hebrew, it's the same Alma. Right? They just changed it to Besula because of this. You know what I'm saying? But the word Alma in each case is translated in the Greek as a young maiden, bearing no prescription regarding her previous sexual experience. So, but the point is that besides context, if you want to give pshat, you have to give me the meaning of the word. Not to mention grammar, because you know what hara means in grammar? Although this could be debatable, but that's certainly what it means in the context. Is pregnant. Not will be pregnant. Jesus wasn't conceived for another 600 years. You know what I'm saying? So out of Christian disputation comes an appreciation for Peshat. See, if you were arguing with a Christian over whether Psalms 22 is actually a prediction of the crucifixion, your best, I mean, I told you this last year also, the best offensive here is to show them you're so far from Peshat. Right?
So, what?
You're so far from Pshat. Psalms 22 has nothing to do with the crucifixion. And then you come home and you're reading your Maseches Megillah at the end of the first perek. And what does the first perek say about Psalms 22? Ayelet HaShachar. What is Psalms 22 about, according to the Talmud?
The Purim
story. The end of Maseches Megillah, perek Aleph, goes verse by verse to show how Psalms 22 is the story of Purim. Hold on.
And as they always said it in the present, and men... in the future. With Shimshon, it was the same.
Hincha hara, we are let it ben.
Right.
You are pregnant. You will give birth to a child. You're already pregnant. When Hashem told it to Hagar in Parshas Lech Lecha, Hincha hara, she was pregnant. That was the whole point. She made herself... even though Rashi there seems to disagree, but still, the pshat of hara means is pregnant. It's the wife of the king. The son of that king was the one who did save them from the Assyrians, for goodness sakes. Okay? There was once a disputation, let me tell you. It was about 980, where a man, when he making this argument, quipped at the end. And by the way, he didn't even save us from the Romans. He didn't. He didn't save us. This child, who's born of this Alma, is supposed to save us, the verse says. He didn't. And they killed him for it.
They killed him for that.
Killed him for being, I don't mean to make light of it, Chas v'Shalom, but they killed him for being disrespectful about, you know, how could you say this is Jesus? If it's Jesus, like, show me who he saved. Right?
So you're saying that Rashi was a reaction to the excess drive of the Christians?
So, yes, that it was before Rashi already, that when, in order to answer disputation, your best solution was pshat. You see, no Jew is going to call you no one will ever call you a heretic if you don't think Psalms 22 is about the Purim story. That's how drash works. In fact, it's rather foolish to take all drash literally, says the Rambam, and many sources long before the Rambam. But to start a new religion and to kill many people who don't buy into it based on these readings is just inconceivable. Excuse the pun. But the point though is that so this is one argument. that the move to Pshat was came along with the proliferation of disputation with Christians, and that it was influenced from outside. Mem Tzadik Segal, in addition to this, mentions another svara that it actually came internally in the Jewish community, and he came up with this after the what was found in the Cairo Geniza. You've heard of the Cairo Geniza? It'll come up again during the year. In the turn of the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century, a treasure trove was found, literally millions of pages, that were sent from Sephardic and Ashkenazic communities to Cairo for a number of reasons. Very dry there, so the papers will not be destroyed by rain. That means there are not a lot of insects under the ground to munch away at pages. So they found pages that were left there literally for 1,000 years, almost intact like the Dead Sea Scrolls. Although that was for 2,000 years, also obviously in a dry climate. So from these works, we found older works that we had no familiarity. And what Mem Tzadik Segal points out is that we started to find questions that very, very different from what you might find today in responsa literature. Well, responsa, what is it? Someone might ask a rabbi, listen, my half-brother died, do I have to sit Shiva? I'm not feeling well, can I do this on Shabbos? Can I eat this on Yom Kippur? Questions, yes or no, or in a practice. What you see is this proliferation in the 9th and 10th centuries from the Cairo Geniza and what we call the Tshuvas HaGaonim and that time period just before Rashi, where people were asking just to explain things. Hundreds and hundreds of tshuvas to explain. I have difficulty understanding the second parak in Maseches Moed Katan. Can you please write me an explanation of the Gemara? And there are hundreds of such requests. So Rashi, again, was a product of this and just was born at the right time, at the right place, for amongst the more traditional community in France and Germany. The communities in Spain and Italy were much more scientific, for a very simple reason. The Jews in France and Germany were surrounded by Christians. There was very little to gain from an association with the outside world. But in Italy and in Spain, the Jews were surrounded largely by Muslims. This is not a clear cut differentiation. But the Jews in the Sephardic world at this time had a much, much steeper knowledge of obviously Arabic, philosophy, science. They were much more steeped in those realms. And hence, when you tend to be more scientific, you tend to be more pshat oriented. What we will do at the end of the first 2 months, after we see Rashi and Ibn Ezra, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you at random 10 verses in the Bible, and just ask you, you're on your own, interpret these 10 verses. And I'll show you that 70 to 80% of the time you will interpret it more like Ibn Ezra, or possibly Rashbam, than like Rashi. Because when you are more scientific and you're more you're thinking more in a philosophical realm, certainly the Arabic speakers, I must tell you, while I don't think anybody in the last 1,000 years had a sixth sense for the Hebrew language like Rashi did, but I'll show you some notions of Rashi the grammarian which were inferior to Ibn Ezra and Radak the grammarians. Simply because while Rashi quotes Arabic sometimes in his commentary, he was not proficient in Arabic like the others. So, and the Arabic connection to Hebrew is very, so strong that it was very helpful. Yes, Alan?
Can you just explain how Rashi ended up in France?
I mean, he was born in Troyes.
Did they go take them from Rome?
Jews migrated for. I don't know how if his father was born there also, but by the time Rashi was born, it was probably an influential French family. His father was a vintner. Rashi quotes his father altogether once in all of his writings. Many people thought that the first Rashi in the Torah was a quote of his father, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Lo Haya Torah, because we couldn't find the source of such a thing. We didn't see where it was. Now we recently found it, also courtesy of the Cairo Geniza, from an old version of the Tanchuma, where if it does appear there in the name of a Tana named Rabbi Yitzchak. His father was named Yitzchak. In all of his writings, he only cites his father once in Maseches Avodah Zarah. We'll get to that. About how to kosher out and purify a wine vat that became impure. Makes sense. His father was a vintner. His father must know how to do these things, right? So anyway, Rashi was born in Shvat. I have to tell you that there were other opinions about where Rashi was born. It's just an amazing, amazing mistake, but in a very important biographical work, it's called the Chidoz book on books from the year 1000 to 1500. He wrote an encyclopedic work describing every author of important books from 1000 to 1500. And he includes Rashi, of course, but he says that Rashi came from Lunil, and that's what Reishin Yud stands for, Rav Shlomo Yarchi. Yarchi for moon, Lunil, which is wrong. There was a Rav Shlomo Lunil, Rav Shlomo Yarchi, and it wasn't Rashi, it was a totally different person. That's a mistake. So it wasn't quite clear where Rashi was from, but everyone agrees he was from France, in the France and Germany area, which would make him from a more traditional background, which means that the yeshivas where he would attend were more like, let's say, Lakewood, where a Radak might have gone to a YU. You know what I'm saying? Although Radak, I should say, went to both. Radak lived on the border of France and Spain and got the best of both educations in his lifetime. But we'll get to that. Okay, so if you see the background of Rashi, there could be a reason klape chutz and klape pnim, right? Whether it's influence from outside or influence from inside, to start to pursue the realm of pshat. And Rashi was just as I said, Hashem put him at the right place at the right time to start to write a commentary that is geared in pshat. However, what is so challenging and often vexing of the student of Rashi is that hundreds of times, hundreds upon hundreds, I mean, if you look at the exaggeration of Ibn Ezra, he says, in my opinion, Rashi is pshat one every 1,000 times that he gives a comment to the Torah, only one out of 1,000 is pshat. Wow. His own grandson, Rashbam, was very, very critical. In fact, Rashbam wanted to establish his own pshat credentials in the first commentary to the Torah. Let me ask everyone in this room, what do the words Bereishis Bara Elokim mean? Well, let's make it easier. What does Bereishis mean? I think I've done this before, so if you were any of you in the room, you know, what does Bereishis mean? Everyone's going to say the same thing, right? What is it?
In the beginning.
No. Okay, that would be a better ultimate shot. But let's try to stick to the exact
one. In the beginning of the creation.
Okay, let's see. There is a I'll tell you I'll quote the pasuk that Rashi quotes. Bereishis mamleches Yehoyakim. It's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. What do those words mean?
At the beginning of the kingdom of Yehoyakim.
Okay, now what does Bereishis mean again?
At the beginning, or
no, you just got it right about the pasuk in Yirmiyahu.
At the head of at the
okay,
beginning
so,
of the.
Beginning all right, of. So what is Bereishis? Now you have it. Yes,
the beginning of the creation.
Bereishis is a construct. Barishona means in the beginning.
Right.
Bereishis means
the beginning of.
Messed up. In the beginning of.
It's a construct.
You have to have something else in between Bereishis and Bara for this to make sense.
Right.
Bereishis something, Bara Elokim as a Shemaim as Oretz. Rashi looks at that and says, you know, it looks to me that the Torah wants to establish itself immediately as a book that asks to be darshaned. Mm-hmm. Why did the Torah choose the word Bereishis more than Barishona? Because if you translate, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, which is what every single... Let me see what this is. I bet this says, in the beginning of creation, God created heaven. In the beginning of God's creating the heavens and earth, when the earth was established.
So it's inserting
this
the...
This perush always tries to be like Rashi.
Which because does. There's a missing word there. Reishit, why?
Right. So Rashi gives you a plethora of shot and drash there. Wait till you see what you find in the Bali HaTosfos and the Rokeach. Amazing, from the Ba'alef Tishrei. Bereishis has the letters Ba'alef Tishrei, right? But you know, there's so many things that you have Bris, Eish, Torah. It's amazing what you can make with the word Bereishis and what they do. And all is fair at this point in Drash, Because what is the rule Rashi often employs here? Since the Torah should have used Barishonah, the fact that it did use Bereshis means that we have now anything we want to say about this word Bereshis we can say, which is, which Rashi says, Bereshis, for the sake of Reshis, did God create heaven and earth. So what is Reshis? So open up a concordance and see how the word Reshis is used. Reshis describes Torah, and it describes the people of Israel. Reshis Darko, Reshis Tuaso. For the sake of Israel, keeping Torah, did God create heaven and earth.
How does he get that?
Because in various verses in the Tanakh, Reshis describes either Israel or the Torah. Other things too. You could say it means for the sake of Israel giving Truma, God created heaven and earth. Reshis describes Truma in one pasuk. Right? You know what I'm saying? Reshis describes Bikurim in a pasuk. For the sake of the Jews giving Bikurim. Rashi doesn't go there. But Rashi did say that this interpretation. Rashbam wants to establish his pshat credentials by saying, look at the chutzpah, your Rashi's daughter's son. And he writes in his very opening commentary, whoever says that this is the pshat of the word Bereshis doesn't know the first thing about pshat. Now, you will not find this in the Mikros Gedolos. When we get up to Rashbam, we'll learn this. Do you know that Rashbam was excised from Bereshis, Noach, and Lech Lecha?
He was what?
It's not found in the... It's cut off. Buy a Mikros Gedolos in this farm store, and you see Rashbam is there for all the 54 parashios, but not the first three, because in the first three, in the printed texts, he's so critical of Rashi. He wants to establish himself. Hey, I'm Rashi's grandson, but I'm not so drash like Rashi. So that's going to be our question. If Rashi, you claim to be pshat, you claim that you want to revolutionize the study of the Torah by saying, "Ani lo basi elo pshuter shamukra." I'm always pshat. So why do you darshan so often? So we can give a lot of answers. Anyone have any thoughts here? After all, when you are first, finish my thought here.
He departed 100%.
Significantly from the way Jews learn drash. You could never go from Talmud to Rashbam. Rashbam never would have been able to go with his very strict pshat if Rashi had not first paved the way for the appreciation of pshat. Right, which was already starting to proliferate, as I said, whether influenced from the inside or the outside. But Rashbam never would have been able to do that. Right, so Rashi's use of Chazal. Let's go to number three quickly. Okay, Rashi's use of Chazal is significant. Rashi quotes Gemaras. He quotes many different sources. Onkelos. You see the 13 points on the front page. This is what we're working with here. Everyone should have. There are two booklets that I gave out.
Yep.
Yeah, that's it. The first one. Yeah. So Rashi's use of Chazal is probably more significant than any of the others that we will study. Right. But he does not blindly quote Chazal. It's not a blind quotation. Okay. Let me just use an example, just to get our feet wet, with a case where Rashi clearly rejects Chazal. Right? It will, we have it here. So let's look it up. In this pamphlet that has the word that says Rashi with the 13 points, you see there it's divided in numbers. You see that? Okay. So we're going to skip all the way down to the Ramban. Okay, no, I have it in a different place. It's going to be on source number 28. Look at source number 28. I'm sorry, the page numbers get cut off at the bottom, but you can look at the numbers of the sources. Look for source number 28. Not in that one, this one. You're looking in the pamphlet that has the 13 points on the front page.
At the bottom.
I'm doing this source right here. See? So, again, well, our purpose here is to discuss how Rashi used the Gemaras in Chazal. When I say Chazal, I mean Gemaras, Midrashim, Unkel, or something. Okay? Rashi is not considered Chazal, right? In this year. So it says, Vayelech ish mi beis Levi, vayikach es bas Levi. Vatar ha'isha batelet ben. That boy is Moshe. A man from the house of Levi went and took a daughter of Levi. She conceived and gave birth to a child. She tried to hide that child against an obvious decree, and she hid him for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she made a plan to put him in the marsh. Now, one of the very crucial points of Rashi is that the Torah does not tell me information I don't need to know. When it says something twice in different words, Rashi is going to try to show you how those two different points say two different things. That's going to be a major issue we're going to deal with. Right? So, the question that Rashi has to deal with here is, one, why does the Torah say, Vayelech ish mi beis Levi vayikach es bas Levi? A man went, just say, Vayikach ish mi beis Levi es bas Levi. Right? Extra word, we have to know why. But also, what Rashi is very concerned with, like the Gemara in Maseches Sota, is why does the Torah tell me how long she was able to hide him? Here it says, everybody in this room knows, how long was she able to hide Moshe?
3 months.
3 months. By the way, what day was Moshe born?
Seven.
So what day was he put into the water?
Shavuos.
Okay, anyway, so fine. But she says she hid him for 3 months, assuming that it was the very next day that she put him in the water, but that would be Shavuos. It's probably drash that Moshe was born on Zion Adar, but it is based on biblical verses. Okay, so anyway, the point is, why does the Bible tell me that she was able to hide him for 3 months? Just say, she tried to hide him, and when she no longer could, she had to work out a plan. What's this? She hid him for 3 months. Anybody know Rashi's solution to that? Excellent, yes. Moshe was born premature. He was born after 6 months pregnancy, and she knew that the Egyptians would count from the time she remarried, and they went 9 months later to various homes to check, to make inquiries about what kind of babies live here. And she knew she had 3 months to hide him. That's Rashi's interpretation. The problem with this interpretation is that it is found nowhere in Chazal. Nowhere is there a Medrash. And one very important point in Rashi. Whenever Rashi says something like this, you must look up Rashi's source, because he never makes this stuff up. A few times in his whole entire parish to the Torah does he come up with something like this, where we don't have the source, and we assume, the scholars in Rashi assume, the source was there, it just disappeared. That Medrash was lost. Rashi does not ever, ever, on his own, make up a drash. It's only because he found it in Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, and the Gemara, and I got it, and the Mechilta, and the Sefer, Sefrei. You know what I'm saying? So where did Rashi get that Moshe was born after 6 months? Because I got to tell you, there is a Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that gives you all the biblical characters born after 6 months. Moshe's not in that list. Shmuel, Yaakov, according to one, Yitzchak, there are different opinions, but Moshe does not make anybody's list of a 6-month baby. So where did Rashi make that up? Second of all, the Gemara in Maseches Sota gives an explanation. It says, how was she able to hide him for 3 months? And the Gemara says, because when Amram divorced his wife, she was already pregnant with Moshe. You know the story. Amram said, "I can't. How can we have children? The Egyptians are killing the boys, and they're enslaving us. So I'm not going to get." And he led a whole group to divorce the wives. Right? That's what this Rashi talks about. Right? Parusha Yamimena, and Miriam convinced them to remarry. Right? You know what I'm talking about? Right? So according to this, The Gemara says she was already pregnant when Amram divorced her. They were divorced for 3 months. When he remarried her, the Egyptian says, we're going to come back in 9 months, and we'll see what you got. And she gave birth after 6 months. In the end, it's the same cheshbon. I had 3 months to hide him, right? He's born on the same day, according to this cheshbon. It's just that according to the Gemara, this was a 9-month baby. And Rashi obviously rejects not one, but two Gemaras to practically fabricate a source that Moshe was born after 6 months. It's found in only one other place in all of traditional rabbinic literature. It's found in some Christian sources, by the way, in Targum Yonah's son to the Torah. But we'll have to learn that Targum Yonah's son to the Torah's source is unknown. We don't know who wrote it, but it appears there. Rashi did not get it from there because Rashi apparently, all the scholars agree, was not aware of Targum Yonah's son to the Torah. What would be your first indication that Rashi is not aware of Targum Yonah's son to the Torah? He never once quotes it in his entire 5 books of Torah. He sometimes quotes what's written there without saying it's Targum Yonah's son to the Torah. What it is, when we get up to number... Rashi's use of onkelos is coming up, so maybe if we have time we'll make a tangent there. So the point, though, is that Rashi rejected this Gemara that said that she was already pregnant before he married her. Now, let me read the pasuk to you and understand why. Listen to the pasuk again. Vayelech ish mi beis Levi, vayikach es bas Levi. Vatahar ha'isho vateled ben. That's the next pasuk. Listen carefully again. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, vayikach et bat Levi. Vatahar ha'isha vatelet ben. It doesn't say she gave birth to a child. It says in the second verse, she conceived and gave birth to a child. Now, tell me why Rashi rejected the Gemara. Right, because according to the Gemara, she conceived before that remarriage. She was already pregnant before the divorce. You following? Rashi will not cite a medrash. Finish my sentence, please.
That is contrary to the Mishnah.
That is contrary to the simple rendition of the words in front of you. Rashi will only cite a medrash if the pshat doesn't really fit the words that are in front of you, or the words that you would expect it to have been there. I'm not going to quote a Gemara. I'm going to have to fabricate a medrash about how she died. Rashi should, in my opinion, Rashi should have left it blank. He shouldn't have even bothered. Rashi doesn't ask every single question the Torah ever raises. But Rashi says, no, I can't leave it blank. Why did the Torah tell me how long she was able to hide him? That is inconsequential information. I don't care. I just care that she had to hide him. Why should I care if it was 3 months or 3 years? When she could no longer hide him, for whatever that reason is, when she felt the gig is up, you're going to come in, you're going to check the house. But why do I need to know that information? All right, so that's answer number three, Rashi's use of Chazal, where it's not a blind usage of the Gemara. It doesn't just mean, well, the Gemara quotes it, so that's a popular medrash, I'm going to quote it. No. And I'll give many other examples of this when we get to it. In fact, one will present itself right now in number four, Rashi's use of onkelos. This isn't really the introductory material here still, is... take a look at source number 58 in this pamphlet. Okay, thank you. Right here. This is a Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin. Tana Rabbanan. Amanas she'ani karyana, kiven shekara shlosha psukim beveis ha'kneses, harezi mekudeshes. At the time of the Talmud, people didn't have so much time to court, so they didn't know so much about each other when they were sitting there under the chuppah, or when he was giving her a ring. So they used to build conditions into the Kiddushin. So the Gemara in the Sefer Kiddushin gives scores and scores of conditions and how to determine that the condition has indeed played itself out. Because if the condition does not play itself out, 58, if the condition does not play itself out, then they are not considered married and they don't even need a divorce. They don't need a get. They were never married because the condition was never found to be true. They don't have to go test it at the moment of the marriage, but sometimes if you're able to, you can. But then you could find out a month later that hey, you lied to me when you said that you were X, what you said, whatever, at the time you gave it. Right? And they have to inquire and see whether that was the true assumption or not. Anyway, one of the things the Gemara discusses is Bal Kori. She always wanted to marry a Bal Kori, she says. So he says, I'm a Bal Kori. Hey, how do you like that? So you better be telling the truth. You say, Hared Mekadesh Yisli Amanash Shanik Bal Kori. So the Gemara says he has to read three psukim in public, in front of a tzibur, and he must translate them. Not enough just to... This is a good proof that a Bal Kori should know what he was saying, right? So he says, so the Gemara asks, any kind of translation? What are you talking about? You can't just say any translation. Right? Yitargin midaite? Votanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Matargin pasuk kitzurasa horeza bedai, vamosif alav horeza machari from a gadev. You can't just give any free translation. If you just translate the Bible the way you like, you may, if the verse he's reading is ayin tachas ayin, and he translates an eye for an eye, oh my goodness, he may be really messing up. You have to translate according to
Uncle Os.
Oh my God. If he does not translate like Uncle Os, which the Gemara calls Targum Didan, our Targum in Babylonia, then if you do not translate like that, because, by the way, at the time of Uncle Os, there were some very popular Targumim coming out of Israel, known as Targum Yerushalmi. That's probably why the Mekoros Gedolos calls it Targum Yonasan. Someone made a mistake. There was an Eretz Yisrael kind of Targum that appeared in the manuscript with Tuf Yud at the top, which always meant Targum Yerushalmi, which means a few things. The Aramaic in Targum Yerushalmi is Yerushalmi Aramaic and has Yerushalmi traditions. Onkelos is Babylonian Aramaic and has Babylonian Talmud Bavli traditions. That is incorporated in the Targum.
Does that mean it was like a drashic translation?
So that's the difference. Targum Yerushalmi is largely drash. It is does not stick to the literal meaning of the words most of the time. There are some times where Uncle Us also veers off of pshat, right? But Uncle Us stays with pshat 95% of the time.
Targum Yerushalmi was more of an originator of pshat than Rashi then. In other words, Rashi was not the innovator.
But no. There's a difference. When you translate something, you're supposed to stay with pshat. Rashi, Sadigon translated the Bible before Rashi, 100 years before Rashi. But the translation, you expect to be somewhat pshat. Don't you? Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but when you're explaining the Bible, which is what Rashi is, a perush, not a translation, so fine, but what Targum Yerushalmi does, Targum Yonasan, Targum Yerushalmi, is that as a translation, Targum means translation, they get off into such drash. Right?
As a translation.
Open up with Mekoros Gedolos next time you have a chance. Look, Targum Onkelos is usually a small, thin little column next to the text. Targum Yerushalmi is this big, wide, long thing on the other side of the page.
When did Onkelos live?
There's a debate in the scholars whether Onkelos is before Yonasan or after. Yonasan of Uziel wrote on the Nevi'im, that the Gemara says, but he didn't write on the Torah. They're both in the 1st century CE.
And he was in
first
Babylon?
Century CE. No, they were living in Eretz Yisrael. They were living in Israel.
Okay. So what stopped the Chassid from doing Targum Yerushalmi?
So there you have it. This Gemara, the question is, what is he trying to exclude by saying you must do Onkelos? His own free translation? I'll lay it right on the floor for you. Christian influence made its way into those Yerushalmi-type commentaries. They were also living in Israel at the time, very much interested in translations of the text of the Torah, of the Pentateuch, right? And the point is that to this day, most of the scholarly work done on Yerushalmi Targumim is today done by Christians. Very famous pastor named Diaz Macho, who has done any scholar who wants to take you study for your orals and then you have to get up to the week on Targumim. You're reading mostly scholarship from Christians. So because they like to show Christian influence on Targumim. All right, it's there because the Christians were writing in Hebrew and they were writing translations. They put it in a jar. Someone finds it 1,000 years later. You think, oh, it's Hebrew. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Aramaic. It's a translation of the Torah. It must be written by a Jew, not necessarily. Right, so this Gemara may be coming to exclude that kind of influence. It's an interesting point, but that Rashi does not make. Rashi says the following, and this is the point I want to make with number four. Rashi says the following. He says, you following? He said, on the second line, Rashi volunteers an example of where Targum Onkelos veers off of the pshat. The verse he chooses is, and he could have chosen many, because as I said, 95% of the psukim in the Torah still allows. Steve, you want to figure that for us quickly? What's 5% of 5,845? Is still something like 270, 275, right? So there are plenty of such cases, and more than that. Because there are whole sections of the Torah, like the brachos of Yaakov, the brachos of Moshe, where Onkelos is not pshat. Anyway, Rashi could have had a huge arsenal at his disposal to choose verses where Onkelos veers off of the pshat. Which one does he choose? No question, a significant departure. The verse says the following. Do not be a contentious person. Lo sa'ane al riv. Do not get into machlokis. Don't be a person of contention. However, the word riv, any balkore here? The word riv is spelled without a yud. Correct. If you're not prepared with the laming, you might read lo sa'ane al
rav.
It's a targum I could live with. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Darshans, do not disagree with your rabbi. or your teacher. In fact, the Gemara learns halacha from here, that when you're new on the Sanhedrin, you vote first. Right? The newest members vote first, because if the most venerable members vote first, then they might influence the others and say, oh no, how can I disagree with their... But if you're voting first, and then you find out that the heads of the Sanhedrin, the people who are on the Sanhedrin for 40 years, voted against, well, what can I do? I voted first. I didn't mean to say other... But if, right? So Lo Sane Al Rif teaches, the Gemara says... That the newest members vote first, as if though the word is Rav. So Rashi cites this as his Onkelos example, because on Onkelos he translates the word as if though it's Rav. Rashi does not suggest that Onkelos had the word Rav there, or that Onkelos that the Hebrew word that the Hebrew that read in the Torah was originally Rav. No, the word is Riv. And Rashi darshans it as if though, however, the word is Rav. So listen, if this would-be chosin gets up there, and he says his three psukim, wow, beautiful three psukim, and when he gets up, this happens to be one of his three psukim, and he reads it, Rashi gives you the Aramaic that it would be, lotasid al-dina, right? Which would be lotane al-riv. Sorry, buddy. You think you're married, right? Uh-uh. Because you didn't give Onkelos. The following? Because you gave your own interpretation, as if though the word is Riv. Now, never mind the Balkori should read Riv, and I assure you, I'm going to eat this if this translation says, don't contend with your rabbi. I'm telling you that... No, it has to. There's no way that an English translation is going to read...
No way.
Yeah, well, you never know, but... It's in chapter 23.
Where?
With
Parsha?
Shmos, chapter 23, and it's verse 2. It says, Lo sane al riv. And it says, do not respond to a grievance by yielding to the majority to pervert the law. Nothing about the rabbi. It's a grievance, riv. Okay, so that would be an amazing. I mean, I'm sure there are some translations that write on the front book. This is a translation of the Torah that sticks only to the Parish of Rashi. I'm sure that something like that probably exists someplace, but you can't call this. I mean, this is an English translation. So Rashi says, if this would be chosam gets up there to the bima and translates as if though the word is riv, the way you have to lane it, right? He's laning riv. But he didn't say like Onkelos. Sorry, buddy. Ain't a Mikodeshus. You're not married. The problem with this is that Rashi, in this commentary to the Torah, source number 60, quotes this Targum Onkelos and disagrees with it. So my question to Rashi is, Rashi, if you wanted to, for your reader's sake, propose an example of a case where you're supposed to agree with Onkelos, for the particular case at hand, but it's a philosophical issue almost. Are we allowed to disagree with Onkelos? Right? Why did you quote an example? You made up this example. The Gemara here in Kedushin didn't say this example. Didn't give any example, actually. It just said you have to say like Targum Onkelos. So you went and gave an example. Now, there's a debate. Did Rashi write his commentary to the Talmud first, or did he write his commentary to the Torah first? All indications are that by the time he got around to writing his commentary to the Talmud, he was well aware of what he was going to write in his commentary to the Torah. Rashi, you know what you feel about Onkelos, about this verse. Why did you cite an example where you disagree? There are many cases where Onkelos has a far departure. I'm going to show you some cases next week. You won't believe the far departures Onkelos takes from Pshat, and Rashi agrees. Sometimes he even quotes it in Aramaic to show that he got it from Onkelos. Right? Why did you quote that one? So what does it mean? I think Rashi purposely in the Talmud cited a case where he disagrees with Onkelos. What does it mean?
Disagrees with what?
That he disagrees with Onkelos. When Rashi disagrees with Onkelos, or let me quickly another example that relates back to number three.
You yourself said that you always do something.
Okay.
His own
and yet, like, Mesorah can be many different ways of reading the biblical text. One of them happens to be Pshat. Now, I'll give you a quick another example and we'll conclude with this. Mishnah says... The Mishnah says that Ha'omer ein tchias ha-mesim min ha-Torah ein lo chelek lo'olam haba. If you don't believe in afterlife from the Torah, you lost your afterlife. So Rashi writes, it's not enough that you have to believe in the afterlife. You have to believe that it is min ha-Torah. And then he writes, where does it say in the Torah? These midrashim that are here in the Gemara, in the beginning of the last parak in Sanhedrin, every Jew must go along with these minatora, these verses, these explanations, and I must tell you, in Rashi's commentary to the Torah, he rejects some of them. Because some of the teachings of Tchias HaMesim in HaTorah, of afterlife from the Torah, is so tenuous and so napshat. No, they exist because the drush is in the Gemara. So I ask you, does Hincha Shochevim Avasecha become Ha'om HaZeh B'Zanach Harei Elohim Acharim teach Tchias HaMesim? Hashem tells Moshe, you're going to die. These people are going to rise up and worship idols after you die. So how does the Gemara learn Tchias HaMesim from there? Hincha Shochevim Avasecha become. You're going to die and rise. So Rashi says, no, rise goes on the people, not on Moshe. Come on. So why does Rashi in his Perush to the Talmud say, if you disagree with this limud of Tchias HaMesim, you're a heretic? Right? And in his Perush to the Torah, he rejects it. So I ask you this question. Does Rashi think that Lo Sa'ane al-Riv teaches don't argue with your rabbi? Does he think... Absolutely. You know why? Because the Talmud says so. But it's not Pshat. So it doesn't get into my commentary. The challenge is, why do so many drushes get into your commentary and this one doesn't? That's why I gave you the example about Tahar or other things like that. You know, you have to always see, why does Rashi darshan some of the time and sometimes he rejects the drush. But if Rashi will say, does Hincha Shochevim Avasecha become teach Tchias HaMesim? Rashi would say, absolutely. Why? Because the Talmud said so. Rashi doesn't agree with one word that the Talmud says. When Rashi, however, challenges the Talmud and says, Eino holecha chayishu v'sham mikra, and he gives an alternate interpretation, he's not saying the Talmud is wrong. He's saying, finish my sentence, Talmud is not pshat. My commentary is pshat. All right? And again, I conclude by saying the challenge for us will be, in the next 3 weeks, is going to be, why then does Rashi so often accept the drash, and sometimes he rejects? I must tell you, that's a doctorate waiting to be written on that. To give some kind of rules. You know, everyone tries to come up with guidelines, and there are always exceptions to each guideline. So when you find the ironclad guidelines, then write a doctorate.
In other words, I'm going to give you the pshat, but that doesn't mean it's the correct understanding. Here's the correct understanding.
Right, there are 70 correct understandings of every verse, Rashi says.
Okay.
There are many different understandings. Hashem said, Hashem yilochem lochem batem tacharishun, God will fight for you, you be quiet. Go there and jump in the water. Does that mean God will make bread for you, but you have to plow? Yilochem, bread. Tacharishun means to plow. It's a nice drash. Is it the pshat? Of course not. But is it something you could say over at Shal Shuddis on Shabbos afternoon? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Chaver, let's stop in Marib, and then we'll start the Makos Shir right after. There's so much to do. If you would be so kind, you could do one of two things. You could take these sources with you, bring them back next week, or you can leave them here in two piles. That might be a better idea, so that we will always have them. Go ahead, everyone. Two piles here, okay?
I think that's how he learned. That's how he had great teachers.
Yes, but very different kinds.
Okay. Hi, how are you, Dara?
How are you?
Fell asleep.